Perfect. Okay, I think we have most of our speakers, and I believe we'll begin to go ahead now as people have been plugging in. Again, we welcome you to this first Interfaith Immigration Coalition call of the year. Thank you for being partners together in faith, really scattered throughout the country. Your voices, your actions have been so significant over the last year, and certainly as we are moving into this new year and as we found ourselves even in the midst of the holidays on the very night that was to have been perhaps one where we have an opportunity to feel a great sense of peace with our families. We were greatly disturbed over the last couple of weeks in hearing the announcement from ICE officials exactly at that time that there indeed were going to be additional enforcement operations that were going to continue and be focused in particular ways against those who have come to the U.S. seeking safety. Indeed, last week and over the New Year's holidays, those raids began. We know that families and the suffering of families continues to increase because of it, and so we have shaped today's webinar to really focus on our faith responses to the raids that have been taking place in recent weeks. And so our first speaker among several will be Jen Smyers, who is the Director of Advocacy for Church World Service Immigration Refugee Project. She will update us on the state of play related to immigration and to refugee issues. We'll move from that to Raul Alcaraz Ochoa, who is with United We Dream. He provides deportation defense, and he can update us about specific consequences of the raids as he is seeing them unfold and help us know where those are happening around the U.S. Reverend Allison Harrington has been a voice of faith throughout the years and a person in action constantly together with her congregation and with many others in giving leadership to the sanctuary movement and through her congregation in Tucson. And Reverend Noel Anderson, a face that has been even in the Washington Post in the last week in helping to provide, as he has for so long, consistent leadership around the sanctuary movement. So we'll begin and move first as we will be focusing on raids targeting Central American families and children to you, Jen, to help bring us into this new year with background of recent actions and efforts that are underway through the administrative actions that we have been seeing, as well as any congressional highlights that are important for us to know now.
Great. Thanks so much, Sharon, and thanks again for everyone who's on the call. So as Sharon mentioned, on Christmas Eve, we started to receive media reports that Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement were focusing a new set of raids to target Central American children and families who had applied for asylum, and either their asylum had been denied or they have a final order of deportation. So immediately, as you all know and can attest to, this really sparked fear in communities around the holidays, which I think was even more heartbreaking than it obviously would have been regardless of when it happened. We started seeing the raids right after the new year began, when many people were, you know, out on vacation or with their families, and again, communities really being afraid to even leave their homes or for that matter, to be in their homes, because the majority of these raids are happening in homes. There are home invasion raids, many of them happening very late in the evening or very in the wee hours of the morning. Secretary Johnson, he put out a statement that was very concerning. I put the link in here if folks want to read through it. It refers to not only the raids and the border enforcement, but it also refers to detaining children, the administration appealing the recent court decision that says that they should not be detaining children and families. It also reiterates the administration's focus on a messaging campaign to discourage migration and specifically to discourage people from seeking protection and asylum, which is very concerning again. We were also, I think, very perplexed to hear the administration continue to use language and to tout policy proposals that we know and have already brought up with them are just inherently wrong morally and in terms of international and domestic law. So, for instance, the administration working with Mexico on their border crackdown to try to deport more people along the Mexican southern border, which we know has resulted in refoulement, which is unsafe return of individuals because Mexico's screening procedures when it comes to asylum are very inadequate. We were hearing Secretary Johnson continue to call individuals illegal immigrants. We know that while many people in our community are undocumented and are receiving a lot of the attention in terms of enforcement across the board, we know that particularly it is not illegal to seek asylum in the United States. And many of these families who were targeted in the most recent raids presented themselves to Border Patrol and were trying to seek asylum. So very concerning. We know that raids have taken place in Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, Missouri, Texas, Illinois, as well as places like Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, despite the fact that the administration has said that the raids were not happening in those states. We know from reports that many people have been picked up in their homes, as well as public places and places of employment. We know that at minimum 71 children and 50 adults have been apprehended, and many of them are at the Dilley Detention Facility for processing. We know that 69 individuals have already been deported, and so this is really moving at a quick pace. We also know that the administration is claiming that this is a very targeted action, that people are only being picked up who, you know, are being targeted. But we know that, again, is not true. I think many of you read one of the first media reports about a mother and her nine-year-old child being picked up, even though the initial person's name on the document that ICE had was for another individual. ICE is claiming that they are apprehending people who have had a hearing and have a final order of removal after January of 2014, and therefore they're considering those individuals recent border crossers. There is still no indication, and I think it's very suspect in terms of what type of legal representation these individuals had, as well as what equities these individuals have in terms of their ties to the community, their family members in the United States, and of course, their status as very vulnerable asylum seekers. We'll go to the next slide here, because I know we're going to be talking mainly about how all of us can be involved in the response. But it's important to lift up that right after we heard about this, there was a rapid response from the faith community. Many of you on the line were involved in supporting the sanctuary movement with congregations across the country, either saying that they support sanctuary or that they are willing to offer up their spaces of worship so that people can seek safety from these raids, either in the long-term way that the sanctuary movement has been being demonstrated, or in short-term ways so that people can feel safe in a temporary way while they're trying to make sense of what's happening on the ground. We also saw some great work from the immigrant rights community in terms of Know Your Rights materials and also lifting up stories of people who were impacted. And I really want to lift up the CARA project, which is a pro bono legal representation project. They're showing that we really can win these cases because they already have won 9 different cases getting a stay of removal and are working on others as well. That being said, there's still a lot of fear in the community, even people not showing up for their hearings because they're afraid of being deported. We saw some positive supportive letters from members of Congress. I think there are 178 members of the House of Representatives who signed a letter to President Obama expressing concern and opposition to these raids as a tactic, many meetings that have taken place, and some candidates who have voiced their opposition to this. It comes as no surprise, and I know that I'm probably just repeating things people have already seen in the news, that Donald Trump has taken credit for this, saying, you know, because he's been talking about this, the administration is following suit. And to be honest, it's probably one of the few things that I personally probably agree with, in that I think that the administration is allowing themselves to be unduly influenced by not only Donald Trump, but a lot of the negative rhetoric that's happening around our immigrant community members. So just two things to note that we've already kind of mentioned, that these raids, while they have received a lot of attention more recently, they are really in addition to raids that have already been happening, deportations that have already been happening, and enforcement actions that have been escalating since the Obama administration started. And again, it is not illegal to seek asylum in the United States by international and domestic law. It is very much within the bounds of how someone can seek protection when they are fleeing persecution. So I want to move to the next slide here and my last slide, which is a little bit different, but I would be remiss to not include in a state of play update that we are also facing increased anti-refugee backlash. I know many of you have been working alongside of us when we're talking about Central American asylum seekers, when we're talking about Syrian refugees and other vulnerable populations. And so just wanted to mention very briefly that late last week there were two indictments of Iraqi refugees who are now living in Texas and California. And it's something that we're continuing to monitor the reports of and be in touch with law enforcement about. But it is really helpful, I think, as we're answering questions from our community and even from media, that we really don't know a lot about these cases. And so we're not putting out statements or making any guesses about what has happened, but we're really focusing in on the fact that we are looking to law enforcement. We're, you know, obviously anyone who's involved in any sort of providing material support to terrorist groups or being involved in anything like that needs to be brought to justice, and we're pleased to see that law enforcement is doing their job on those pieces. But I think it's very important that you know, these two Iraqi individuals do not represent Iraqi refugees or any of the many, many diverse groups of refugees who are members of our community. And of course, we have people of all walks of life who make wrong choices and who are engaged in behavior that all of us condemn. And so this is really a broader issue than a refugee or an immigration issue. And I think that, unfortunately, it's likely to fuel anti-immigrant, anti-refugee sentiment. And I think that as the faith community, it's a really important moment for us to lift up our solidarity with people who are fleeing persecution, whether that be people who are from Iraq or Syria who are entering through the U.S. refugee program, whether that is Central American children and families who are seeking safety in the United States. So I think that these issues are interrelated. We're going to focus mostly today on the deportation of Central American families and the response and how all of us can be part of that prophetic witness and response to stop these raids from happening and to also drastically shift the administration's focus to be one that can be really focused on legal representation for children and families and individuals who are seeking asylum and protection, and also humanitarian assistance in the region where these individuals are fleeing the persecution. So I will turn it back over to Sharon, and I hope that that was helpful.
Thank you so much, Jen. Absolutely, it was. Again, this is Sharon Stanley Ray with Disciples of Christ. And I want to encourage, we've had some folks in the chat responses have difficulty hearing the call. We've asked for folks to consider calling in for the audio portion. Again, our number is 641-715-3670. 641-715-3670, and we've put that number also into the chat function. That will give you audio, and then you can click for the visual portion of the presentation to the link, join.me/theWordFaith, F-A-I-T-H, number 4, and then immigration. And we are continuing on this call for some reason to have a number of folks. You look beautiful through your webcams, but if you could look for the small button that shows the picture of a camera, there should be a way that you can individually block that. And although we would love to see you all, if we do see all of your pictures, that unfortunately blocks the words behind that our presenters have on the screen. Thank you so much. We want to move now to learn through Raul Alcaraz Ochoa, who has been working with United We Dream, as we have been hearing from Jen already, even though we're just 10 days now 11 days into the new year already, we have seen horrific raids that have been targeting and frightening so many. And Raul and United We Dream have been on the front lines of helping to ensure that we have full information to share with each of the immigrant communities who are feeling at risk about what to do, how to protect themselves. And we want to turn it now over to you, Raul, to also help us understand what the hotline work is, what it has been doing, and how we can share that with those we care about. So we'll turn it over now to you, Raul.
Yes, thank you so much, Sharon, and everyone here on the call. So my name is Raul, and as part of United We Dream, we are in really a tragedy and in emergency crisis kind of mode. And we consider these government actions by the part of the Obama administration, the Democrats and the Republicans, and we condemn them. We don't consider these removal orders legitimate because they are not, and they're also immoral in that sense. And because these deportations come with the possibility of people getting a death sentence, right? And we see that the judges and courts tend to not understand what is politically happening in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and the, like you mentioned, the previous presenter mentioned the lack of legal access and representation, and there's also a huge blind spot in how the U.S. is involved in this and the millions of dollars in economic aid given to corrupt police and military forces in those countries, and how the U.S. has actively conspired to destabilize Central America. So in that sense, you know, there's also a need to look into more of the root causes as to what has caused the conditions and the situations that have forced people to flee persecution, violence, and displacement. And so with that context, you know, that larger global context and the U.S. role within that and how the political parties here on both ends are responding, our community has become to find itself in a state of panic and in a state of crisis. And so as United We Dream, we have a hotline that we established in 2014 with the purpose of tracking and monitoring ICE activity. And how they're pursuing their post-DHS memos and new priorities for that took place in 2014 with the Obama announcement of DACA, the expansion of DACA and DAPA. And so we wanted to become ears and eyes of ice activity happening so that we're able to track and see and monitor how things are happening and how our community is experiencing enforcement. And so people call our hotline, and we talk to caller depending on the call. We talk about what their rights are, and we go over the usual, you know, in terms of not opening their doors under any circumstances to suspected law enforcement agents, to carrying all and any court and immigration documents if they have those, to insist on speaking on a lawyer, to not sign anything, to remain silent, and have a plan ready. And so we've gotten quite a number of calls. Between January 2nd and January 8th, we received 274 calls to our volunteer-run hotline. So we've been super swamped. And so, you know, besides the trauma, the violence, and the damage that ICE has caused on our communities, they're also giving us that are fighting for social justice a lot more work. And so what we've seen have been different examples of abuse and violence. For example, we have a home in Brunswick, New Jersey, that was raided by 15 agents on January 4th. In the early morning hours, they kicked down the door, assaulted two people in the home, handcuffed the father, and took their son into custody. So we had that case of a caller inform us of that. And so we're following up with that case. And we also have another instance in Centerville, Virginia, where ICE knocked on the door to detain a 17-year-old unaccompanied minor from Guatemala that came in 2014. She had a court still pending and did not know she had an order of deportation because they never received anything in the mail. Luckily, the father did not open the door. And so we have a group that's working with them, Dreamers of Virginia, in that area. So we've seen these cases. And another thing that we've also developed in terms of supporting people be more prepared in case of situations like this is something that we started in Arizona when we saw that SB 1070 was coming in 2010. And so we started the protection network, what we call the protection network model, which is a type of mutual aid support organizing kind of model where community come together to develop their own family plans in case there is a raid, a detention, or a deportation. Or and beyond the family plan, it becomes also a community plan where community members and different families get together to support one another in different circumstances and under different elements. And so what we have with the protection network is we have the community to first and foremost to be informed about what their rights are. So whether it's ICE coming knocking on their door or whether it's that they're pulled over while driving to work and how to interact with an agent, and also their rights if they are detained, and then also the rights if they find themselves in an immigration court bond hearing. We also do trainings on how they themselves can represent themselves in those type of hearings. So we do Know Your Rights trainings and go to people's homes that invite us and where they invite their neighbors, their family, their friends, people directly affected, and we do trainings, and then they invite other people, and then we have more home Know Your Rights. And so what we mobilize people for is to also have a plan ready of where their children will be if they are detained, if the parents are detained, what's going to happen to their children, what's going to happen to their home, what's going to happen to their car, to their bank accounts. So we provide power of attorney forms so that they can get people that they trust to be ready with those kinds of paperwork in case that becomes a necessity. We also linked up with pro bono legal support in our local area so that there's lawyers on call that can help with our community with responding to a situation, and we intake beforehand so that if a person is taken, we already have all their information and what they could possibly qualify for, what they could, how they have a form of relief. And we also have a rapid response system. So it's a matter of people that are part of the group, that they reach out to somebody in the group or text if they were apprehended or if a raid is happening, that the designated people from the group get that information so that we can activate the response network so that people and legal observers can go to the scene, so we can document, so we can record and respond to that situation or protest or do some kind of direct action in depending on the situation. We also do visitations and letter writing support. If a person is in detention and it's funneled into the detention system, then we also provide visitations and do support, letter writing support for their court hearings and also for just their moral support so that they feel that there's a community that is backing them up. And then also, as part of the protection network model, we also do grassroots fundraising. So the community themselves organize events, whether it's car washes, yard sales, benefit dinners, and they fundraise money to a collective account where that money is, like, there's a lot of agreement conversations that take place, and people that are committed to this protection network are also, in case of a situation where there's a detention or a deportation, that there's funds available either for bond or for a 1 month's worth of rent if the breadwinner was taken, and different situations that come out of a detention. There's also a defense fund. And then the final piece of this protection network model is beyond just the kind of mutual commitment and beyond, like, service providing. It's also about how do we become advocates and organizers, and people directly impacted become their own leadership to change the conditions that they're facing, so that we don't have to live in a community that needs and requires a protection network because our government is failing and because the government and immigration is persecuting our community. We have to turn to that kind of self-benefit, self-organization. And so we also do organizing to, for example, in Tucson and Houston, campaign work to separate the local law enforcement from immigration enforcement. And so carrying out campaign work that deals with changing the local policy and the local landscape and the structure so that communities can live freer and with greater dignity. So in a nutshell, then, through United with Dream, we have various elements that to help the community empower themselves, and the hotline being one piece, and the community engagement and organizing, and the protection network model being another. So those are ways that that we have engaged community to better respond to and be more prepared and organized for a situation where a raid or a detention or a deportation may take place.
Wonderful information. Thank you so much. And Raul, as we are continuing to gather so much good information from you, and I think faith communities who are part of the call are interested to begin to think of how they can more deeply, through using some of the strategies you mentioned, help support communities that are in their area. I want to invite folks who are on the call to consider going ahead and clicking on the middle green button that's at the top of your screen. That's the chat button. Feel free to start putting questions that you have for Raul into the chat function so that we can pick them up through our conversation that we'll look forward to having during our question and answer time at the end. Again, as a reminder, we are recording the full presentation today, so that will be sent out to you. It will be posted again on the Interfaith Immigration Coalition website so that you can access both the full audio and visual portions of every presenter's information to us today. And at this time. With great thanks to you, Raul. We look forward to coming back to you with questions momentarily. But we're going to move next to really focus on the sanctuary movement, first through a presentation by Noelle Anderson, who will help us relook at how the sanctuary movement is connected to our faith values and sacred scriptures, how it has functioned historically in the 80s, since 2007, and again very recently in over the last 18 months. So, Noelle, you are next up, and following that, we'll be learning from Reverend Allison Harrington about how we can strengthen a sanctuary movement locally, how she did that in partnership with her congregation at Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona, and how we in our own congregations can consider doing the same. Noelle, we'll turn it to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Sharon. So glad to be with you all today. And my apologies if there's a little background noise. I'm at a conference here in New York right now. So the sanctuary movement, I think everybody knows the basics of it, of what this is about, everybody who joined the call. And it's been a growing movement. It started, of course, as many know, from our faith tradition. From our sacred texts, from our history of offering sanctuary, even in the Hebrew cities of people fleeing unjust laws. Next slide, please. And, of course, in the context that we know it, the more well-known in the 1980s for protecting the Central American refugees fleeing civil war. Now, we can't help but notice today the similarities of asylum seekers fleeing gang violence, extreme poverty, and persecution. Just as in the 80s, if the asylum seekers are deported now, they could also likely be met with the same violence that they're fleeing, costing them their lives. Next slide, please. So then there were in the Bush administration, we saw huge workplace raids. Over 400 people in Postville, Iowa, amongst other many cities throughout the country saw these raids. And one of the responses of the congregations was to call upon a new sanctuary movement model that fit the era of the time and really just protected people from the raids, from deportations. And many think that the 2007, 8, 9 efforts really gave way to the Morton memo, the sort of first version of prosecutorial discretion we saw, and also really helped build a network that was organized of people of faith that are working on immigrants' rights. Next slide. And that's a picture of the Oregon New Sanctuary Movement. And go ahead, next slide. I think they're also now called the Interfaith Immigrant Rights Movement, or Interfaith Movement. Well, someone should correct me on that one. So Emerge. Sanctuary 2014-2016, over the last 18 months, the Sanctuary Movement has worked on 12 sanctuary cases, winning relief from deportation for 10 people in 8 cities throughout the country. And our network is about 300 congregations and in 30 states. And we just, through the groundswell petition, we've seen about 250 people sign up, congregations, faith leaders, that want to support the sanctuary movement. And we're hoping that many of them are on this call today and that they could continue to get involved, get more information, and work to become a congregation that is offering a sanctuary. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today more, and that's what Allison will be handling a lot of, is how to do the work of sanctuary. But sanctuary in 2014 really put the escalation of public pressure, of the moral voice, of the prophetic leaders and stories of immigrants at the forefront of the national debate, and really helped win executive action that could benefit up to 5 million undocumented people, along with, of course, all of our other movement efforts. And unfortunately, we are still working to try to get that through the courts. So go ahead and next slide, please.
And that's a picture of the Philadelphia New Sanctuary Movement. So our goals at the local level are to basically stop that deportation and to keep that family together. And that's at a case-by-case level, and we've seen success with this. And this is also how we help educate people and lift up the stories and the powerful leadership of those immigrants courageous enough to take sanctuary. Next slide. And then we have our national goals, which are at this point many, and the sanctuary movement plugs into many of the larger goals of the immigrants' rights movement. So first of all, right now, to stop the raids, to stop targeting Central Americans fleeing violence, and as well to work with ICE and target ICE and the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, to help them improve their implementation process of prosecutorial discretion guidelines that were laid out in the November 20th, 2014 guidelines. We're also, supporting the pushback against enforcement, against the new secure communities program called the Priority Enforcement Program, or 287G. Many cities have an ICE out of LA or ICE out of your given city to try to get ICE out of the jails where many of the deportations are coming from. And eventually we do hope to see a pathway to citizenship at some point, that type of legislation that we could actually get behind. Next slide, please. So I want to hand it over real quick here to Megan to say a word about the amazing work she's been also very much supportive and part of as our communications person on Sanctuary, to talk a little bit about the media we've gained and how that's helping us gain momentum as well as we continue to build our movement.
Thanks so much, Noel, and thank you again for everyone who's joined and for all of the other speakers. As Noel said, a lot of the media that we have been doing over the last several weeks and certainly in the past as well has been to help bring attention to the immoral and unjust immigration policies that our country currently implements, which is causing so many to seek sanctuary. And so through the media, one way that we've used it is to help bring attention not only to the immigration policies, but also to help stop the raids, as we've seen over the last few weeks. We've also helped to share information about sanctuary and lift up specific cases, especially in 2014 when there were numerous people seeking sanctuary. As you can see, we've had several national stories recently in Reuters and in the Washington Post and in several other national outlets. But one of the things that we really try and lift up are the local stories, because those tend to have the most impact. Local decision makers and congregations as well really pay attention to local news stories, things that are in their neighborhoods and in their communities. So as you can see, these are just two of many, many stories that have been published in the last several weeks, one in the Arizona Republic, one in the Morrow County Sentinel in Ohio. And you can see that those stories get a lot of traction, and people start to think about how immigration policies impact their communities and how they can help. As someone who works in communications, I'm always happy to assist and to help lift up the stories of congregations who are stepping up and offering sanctuary and those who are offering support as well. I will turn it back over to Noel so that he can continue the presentation, but we're always happy to lift up the stories and the voices of congregations and of those seeking sanctuary.
And Megan's available to help with any press work you might need. Next slide. So I'm going to turn the presentation over to Reverend Allison Harrington, but real quickly, before we get into that, we have a really great announcement if Pat Fling from Action, a PICO affiliate in Northern Nevada, if you could just and just a phrase or two, tell us what a little bit of exciting news that you heard today. I think you're just now going public with it. And you probably have to press *6.
Okay,
are you there?
We have great news. We were blocking the deportation of a local man from Mexico who has a wife and two children, and he went into sanctuary at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Reno, and today ICE announced a one-year stay of his deportation.
That's great news. Thank you, Pat, for sharing. And in that case, they first went into private sanctuary and was eventually able to use that as part of their leverage with ICE to win that stay of deportation. And I think they'll have a press release that we can send out later. So thank you for that, Pat. And, turning it over to Reverend Allison Harrington, who's been an amazing leader in the sanctuary movement. And we're very glad to have her on this call and to be helping lead this every day. She's talking to pastors, and she's definitely willing to talk with you, I'm sure, about what does it mean to do the sanctuary work and build this out more at the national level. So thanks, Allison, for being with us.
Thank you, Reverend Anderson. Yes, I would be happy to talk to all 300 of you. It really is the great joy of my work right now is to come alongside other churches and other pastors who are excited about doing this work. So, Southside Presbyterian Church was one of the founders of the sanctuary movement. And I think someone needs to mute their phone.
Yes, everyone, please put your own phones on mute.
Yeah. There we go. Okay, there we go. So we really do feel as if we are living through another nightmare where we're seeing Central Americans, like Noel referred to, being deported back to certain death. One of the things that I do want to say is that while our faith is a thing that kind of orients us to this work, it is our courage that also leads us forward as we seek to stop the deportations of our brothers and sisters and our community members. So as we talk about how we're responding today, I want to talk a little bit about what we've been doing in the last year and a half or so. Next slide, please. So you see a picture. This is Daniel and Rosa. They are two of the 12 folks that have entered sanctuary in the past year and a half. Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice was the organization that Noel was referring to in Portland, Oregon, and many of our other partners across the nation have been doing bold and courageous work to stop deportations. Next slide, please. And much of this work, we have learned there's a lot of people on this call right now who have been doing sanctuary work for a long time, whether you were involved in the 1980s or in 2006, whether you've been working alongside us in the last couple of years, we have, here at Southside, we have learned a great deal from you all. And many of you on this call, I know you have supported Daniel and Rosa and the other people in sanctuary through signing the Groundswell petition, and you have come alongside them, and you have contributed to this groundswell, this moral outcry that has happened that we've been part of to say to the Obama administration that these are our neighbors and we don't want to see them torn from our communities. Next slide, please. Daniel was in sanctuary here at Southside for 28 days. Before he was granted a stay of deportation. And well, the interesting thing that happened was that we were not the first people to think about doing sanctuary, just like in the 1980s. Other people had also been thinking about it. But we were the first ones in terms of a timeline to declare sanctuary. So after Daniel entered in the sanctuary, there was kind of this ignition of the movement, and we were getting calls from across the country of other congregations, other communities of faith who also wanted to do this work of sanctuary. And so with Daniel entering sanctuary, it not only protected his family and kept his family together, but it began this new movement of protecting people from deportation. Next slide. And then Rosa entered in a sanctuary not too long after him, and she was with us for 461 days before finally being able to safely leave sanctuary. And many of you stood alongside her, calling for her deportation to be stopped. One of the, I'll talk a little bit more about her case when we get into some of the logistics. Next slide, please. So, in the past year and a half, the people that have been seeking sanctuary are those who do have a reasonable potential of having some kind of administrative relief, whether it's through a stay of deportation, a stay of their removal and order of supervision, or some other kind of administrative relief. And so those folks who have been coming to the different congregations, the different grassroots organizations, they've had a reasonable avenue for relief. One of the things that we don't want to do is we don't necessarily want to put someone in sanctuary who doesn't have relief available to them. Just because they don't have relief available to them doesn't mean that we think that they don't also deserve the protection. It's just that we might want to find different ways of coming alongside them than the strategy of sanctuary. Because sanctuary often is such a public thing where we're lifting up the stories and we're having them be spokespeople and to really share their stories, and we're advocating for them. And sanctuary is hard work. It's hard for a family to be in sanctuary, so we want to make sure that those who are entering sanctuary have a way to have their case resolved in a rather quick way, knowing that 461 days is not exactly quick. So what we've been experiencing nationally is that those who are entering into sanctuary, they work with a legal team who is able to assess kind of what are the avenues in which they could pursue to have their case closed or some form of administrative relief. And then that team talks to the pastor and the others who are part of the campaign to think about how they might proceed. We clearly, like in Reno, we clearly have, like 2 million people who need relief and who need to be able to have a way to stay within our communities. And so we still have people even today who are not these, who are not Central Americans, but still should not be deported back and be torn from their families. Right now, we're particularly focused on giving sanctuary to Central American families just because we do know the great violence that they are returning to. And so we're trying to come alongside them. And as Jen mentioned in her presentation, many of these folks who are being targeted for apprehension have not had, quote unquote, their day in court. And so there are still a number of different legal avenues that can be pursued for each one of these cases. Next slide, please. So there's a lot of ways to declare sanctuary. There's actually not a form on the government website. Some people sometimes think there is. There's not a form that the government says, please fill this out if you're declaring sanctuary. But rather, we come together as a community of faith to lift up our faith values, to say that we are called through our scriptures to a radical practice of hospitality that protects people from violence, that comes alongside and keeps families together. And we really, as communities of faith are discerning sanctuary, we really encourage people to enter into a time of prayer and education and reflection so that when a case does arise, they are able to act very quickly. We often don't have a lot of lead time when someone is needing sanctuary. We might have nothing more than a couple of days to be able to act. So even if you don't think that there's a case on the horizon for you, you should start talking about it with your congregation because we know that sometimes these processes in congregations can take a year. So we're going to be needing to do this work for a long time. So we're encouraging people to really be considering and be discerning what God might be calling them to do within this particular historical moment. And once the congregation has made that decision to declare sanctuary for an individual, we generally announce that to the public through a press conference and through prayer vigils, and we're very upfront with the act of sanctuary, especially in the moment when that family enters into the premises of a house of worship. Next slide. So with Rosa's case, I was hoping here in Tucson that we would have another church that would take Rosa's case and offer her sanctuary, but no one else was quite ready to do it. And so what we decided to do is we ran Rosa's case as a Sanctuary 101 training for others. And we invited other congregations to come and walk alongside us and work alongside us as we offered her sanctuary. It was our hope that through this practice, other people would learn how to do sanctuary, and their experience of sanctuary would be a way in which they could discern their own call within their own congregation to the work of sanctuary. And it's like my one good thought ever. It was like my one brilliant idea in my lifetime to do this because it worked really well. The way that we practice sanctuary at Southside is we have daily prayer vigils. And when Daniel was in sanctuary, I led every single prayer vigil for the most part. When Rosa entered in sanctuary, I had 20 other faith leaders who were helping me to lead those prayer vigils. And we had a number of different congregations that were walking alongside us, and three other congregations, actually, who through that process were able to come to an understanding with their congregation that they would be willing to offer sanctuary, and they actually did. We had a couple other cases here in Tucson. And so we encourage people to partner with other faith communities. It may be that you're a pastor or a leader in a church, and you all have a passion, but you don't have the facilities. There's literally no place where that could be dedicated for a living space for an individual. That's okay. You could partner with another congregation who may have the space but may not have the capacity. They may be a small little church with an older congregation that don't have the energy that they once had. And so you can partner with them, and you can build these networks of sanctuary in your own community. So we really encourage people, if you're considering it, reach out to other pastors, other faith leaders in your community to find out who else is interested in doing this work. The next thing is, you know, somebody who we didn't do this at Southside, but in Denver they did this, and it's a brilliant, wonderful idea. We encourage you to create a covenant between the faith community and the person in sanctuary, so that it's clear up front what is expected of the community of faith and what is expected of the person in sanctuary. Sanctuary is tough work. It's a huge blessing, and the greatest gift of my ministry has been to be involved in this work. But there are a lot of power dynamics involved, and it's good if you can just have hard conversations up front about how the church might financially support the family, and to have all these kind of conversations up front is a good way to go. And then we encourage people to create working groups that can do the work of sanctuary. So whether it's a hospitality group that is coming alongside the person, making sure that they have everything that they need, that the room that they are going to be living in is comfortable for them, whether you want to have some kind of ongoing presence of congregation members at different times so the person could feel surrounded by the support and love of the congregation. We also really, you know, a big part of the sanctuary work is communications, telling the story. And so we encourage people to begin to think about what your talking points are. How do you want to tell this story to your local media, to your local communities? And then also a working group around the campaign work. Certainly a big part of offering sanctuary is just the offer of hospitality that keeps the family together. But alongside that, we need to mobilize, we need to advocate, we need to do everything that we can to keep somebody's, to get a positive resolution to somebody's case. And so I think all of the sanctuary cases to date that have been public have had a groundswell petition. That is an amazing way to garner the support of faith communities across the nation. There's also a lot of things that you can do locally. Get your local YMCA, your local unions to write letters of support. We here in Tucson, we have the city council and our board of supervisors pass resolutions in support of the folks that have been in sanctuary. We've done a variety of different things locally to put out yard signs for Rosa's campaign. The We Stand With Rosa signs were a huge part of our campaign. I mean, all of this is working to so that the person can leave sanctuary and return to life as normal. And then another important thing is to stay rooted in your spiritual practices. I can't tell you that after 461 days of doing the hard work of sanctuary, we would not have been able to do it if it wasn't primarily for the courage and faith of Rosa, and also rooting ourselves in prayer on a regular basis. Next slide, please. So this is one of the questions that everyone wants to know. Are we breaking the law? So it's a difficult question to answer. I'm going to answer it in two ways. Law is a lot like scripture. I think it's up to your interpretation. So every lawyer you ask will probably have a different sort of answer. One of the charges that we do risk with sanctuary is the charge of harboring. But the reality is that if we are being public with a sanctuary case, no one is being concealed, and so the argument could be made that it's actually not harboring, that we are upfront with law enforcement, that we have someone in sanctuary. I'm sure even in Reno, though that case wasn't public, they were still in dialogue with local law enforcement. And so if we're being transparent, I would argue, that's someone with no law degree, that it's not harboring. But everyone should really, discern this with your own congregation, with your own board of leaders, and reach out to a lawyer that you trust to really discern this. But here's the thing that I want to say. It doesn't matter if it's breaking the law. Because just like we were saying back in the 80s, the United States government is breaking the law. They are not following asylum practices and procedures. And they are the ones who are breaking the law. They are the ones who are invading people's homes and tearing apart families, deporting people back to death. And as John Fife always likes to say, when human lives are on the line, the only ethic that is left to us is the ethic of resistance. And it is our job to stand alongside these people. Courage, we say all the time, courage is fear that has said its prayers. And so I know that for faith leaders, you might have someone in your congregation who pledges a lot of money, and they might be a law and order type of person who says, this is breaking the law, and if you do this, I'm going to leave. Well, I encourage you to be courageous in those moments, and I encourage you to think about those moms who sent their precious babies, their precious children, north, out of violence, into what they thought was going to be refuge. Think about the courage that they had and the way in which they said their prayers. And I encourage you to be courageous. One of the moments for me that was very powerful in this work that encouraged me to think about how could we as a body of Christ be more risky in proclaiming our faith was Raul. Raul, when he was living here in Arizona, on a daily basis had to get calls from families who were being torn apart. And finally, one day when he was on his way down here to the church to work with our day labor center, he saw a law enforcement stopping a man who had children in the back of his car. And Raul put himself underneath that Border Patrol vehicle, preventing that family from being taken away. Even if it was just for a couple hours, he put his body on the line. And it is time for the body of Christ to get under these vehicles in a metaphorical way, to disrupt the mechanics and the machinery of deportations. It is absolutely up to us. Next slide, please. And I want to say one last thing in conclusion. We have millions of people right now moving, fleeing, running for their lives across this across our globe, and we the communities of faith. We have a unique gift to give. And in different social justice movements, we often think, well, what is our gift to give? Here, when it comes to refugees, asylum seekers, migrants, we have the gift of sanctuary. Nobody can do this but us, because this is a practice that comes out of our faith traditions. And so it is up to us to open our doors, open our hearts to those who are facing death. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Allison. Thank you, Noel. Powerful, powerful statements. And we're going to move now into a time of questions and answers. I would encourage folks to please stay on the line if you can, because we've had a number of questions. that have come through. And Raul, I think we'll begin with you to move our way through some of these as quickly as we can. One person was asking again for the number to call, and I can repeat that and just say it's 1-844-END-1-ICE. And that will also be coming to you in the follow-up from the resources that will be sent your way. You can send to the hotline. You can text WATCH-ICE at 877-877. And Raul, if you're on the line, can you answer the questions, please, about resources being available in Spanish? I'm sure the answer is yes, but perhaps you can tell folks where to find them. Also, people are interested in getting copies of the If ICE Comes to Your Door card. We'll turn it over to you. And then if you'll also speak about whether there are chapters and allies in various states and whether there is a need for volunteers to assist United We Dream. We'll start with those questions.
Sure. Yeah, I have resources. I mean, our webpage is unitedwedream.org. And if you wanted to make more direct contact with more resources, you can email me at raul@unitedwedream.org. And one quick resource that I would like to share is this other website called adminrelief.org/legalhelp. So adminrelief.org/legalhelp. And you type in, it gives you an option to put a zip code where the person that's seeking free legal services is located. And you type that zip code and legal services in their area will appear. So that's one other resource as well that we use in the hotline when people, since we're not lawyers, they want to be referred with someone regarding a case of a person not in detention, we refer them there. And in terms of allies and support needed, also, you could email me if you or people that you know are interested in helping with the hotline. We always need help with that. We can set up a training for that. And for folks that are or congregations that are interested in supporting your members, if you see that they have this need of a protection network or of more of your Know Your Rights material, trainings and or support with even beginning a protection network, which could look different in your area. The one that I described was, you know, being there with Reverend Allison in the Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona, is a different context than where you are. So there's many similarities and there's also many differences. And so we could also help, you know, I could help with the assisting in terms of seeing what how it could be tailored to your audience as well. So yeah, I would be more than happy to jump on a call as long as it's not 300 people in one day. please get back to me if you have any other questions or information that you're seeking regarding how to be an ally with directly impacted communities.
Thank you, Raul.
Can I say something really quick?
Sure.
That there's probably a ton of questions, and the one thing that I did neglect to say is that that there are the pastors who have been doing the sanctuary work and many of the leaders, we would be happy to talk to folks with detailed questions. We really want to develop a team of like sanctuary coaches that come alongside individual congregations to help them about logistics and discernment and things like that. So people can reach out to me as well. My email is AllisonHarrington@yahoo.com.
Great. Thank you, Allison. And we'll try to put your email into the chat function as well as Raul's that we already just put in there. There are additional questions, and I would invite Raul, either you or Allison or Noel, to respond about ways that folks can assist best when they are seeing ICE disobeying the warrant rules beginning to make arrests, and any additional comments that you all would like to make in regards to best practices that advocates can use to assist folks who are being affected by raids. Raul, do you want to take that question first, perhaps?
Oh, sure. I was going to see if somebody else wanted answers since I just answered. But, yeah, I'm more than happy to. What has been really effective is if allies are seeing these things happening in front of them, we encourage people to take out their cell phones or their cameras. We usually do a know your rights, you know, for people that are going to be doing that kind of stuff, because it does come with certain consequences. But if folks are willing and feel comfortable doing that, and aren't in immediate risk of detention or deportation, or, you know, just know their rights in general, we want to make it the invisible visible. So these things, you know, happen really quickly. They happen in the middle of in the morning, in the early morning hours, and they happen privately, anonymously, and usually the people directly that they came for, or that they stopped, or that they apprehended, are the ones that see it. And usually people are, you know, are really in a state of shock and panic, so they're not thinking of necessarily filming it necessarily, and that could come with the risk. So if there are people that can document this stuff, we really need to get it out there to the media and to the public of these things that are happening, to make it more visible. And folks can forward it to me as well. Folks can feel free to use the hotline number as well to report these things that you're seeing. Writing down, like, if the family left behind is still in your community, you can feel free to forward us their number so that we can see what ways we can also support or support you in supporting them, and by getting their contact information as well.
Great. And Allison, we're having questions as well about some best ways to identify candidates who might be especially good to go into sanctuary.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the most important things about the sanctuary work are the relationships that support that work. And so local churches should reach out to legal clinics that might exist in their area. I know that, or local grassroots organizations that are in contact with the undocumented community, that would be a great way. I do want to say that, you know, as people of faith, we can't get caught into a framework of who's a good candidate and who's a bad candidate. And I know I said we want to make sure that someone has a reasonable avenue of relief. But you know what? Some of our folks have DUIs. Some of our folks have criminal history, quote unquote criminal history. But we need to push back against kind of the idea that some folks are good for sanctuary and some folks aren't. You know, there's been people who've entered sanctuary who have had criminal charges, and, you know, we're a people who believe in forgiveness and second chances. We're also people who know that there is disproportionate policing in communities of color that lead to conviction rates higher for people of color than for white folks. And so finding a good candidate means a lot of different things. You know, so often when a person is in sanctuary, they need to be able to really feel as they're part of a movement, and that the work that they're doing is for the benefit of many people, because sanctuary is hard work, and we find that those who are able to really stick with it and to do best in those kind of conditions are the ones who see themselves as part of a movement and a leader within that movement. But people should definitely reach out to their local legal clinics and communities, other, you know, Spanish-speaking congregations. You know, we're not really sure how this is all going to unfold, but I know that when Raul is talking to people on the hotline, one of the questions that he's going to start asking folks is if they're interested in entering into sanctuary. And so it may be that we will be identifying people nationally and then plugging them in and making those connections locally.
And great. This is Noel. If I could add in a few closing thoughts as well. I mean, first of all, it's important to remember that 30 of the 121 people that were detained last week were actually Mexican, of Mexican descent, and we know that the raids are not just picking up Central Americans; they're also targeting picking up whoever they can along the way, who might be in the line of the raids. The other thing, we're not sure, but as we understand it, these raids aren't stopping anytime soon. And in fact, there's been even hearsay, rumors of meetings with DHS that they may target unaccompanied children next. So, and this sanctuary is one important way to create a moral outcry of these outrageous attacks on our community, but it's not the only way to respond to the raids. And if you are connected to an immigrant church, you should also be making sure that they get the Know Your Rights material and making sure that there's a workshop happening in your congregation. There may be other ways in which your congregation, we're still developing this, how we can develop a rapid response to those, for those, how can we support and create a safe haven space for people who may get swept up in the raids before the raids even happen. So that's not a model that we've developed yet, but it's something that's in the works. And then the other thing, there was a question, I think it's an important question, could sanctuary make it worse off for somebody's case? Well, that really is case by case. And if we look at the case and we talk to the lawyer, the person should always have a lawyer. We shouldn't be taking anyone into public sanctuary or private sanctuary without having a lawyer. And so then it doesn't make sense to take that case. But if it could strengthen the work and strengthen their legal case, then that's when, you know, it would make sense to take that case where we could actually win a stay of removal for them. In terms of bail, we haven't ever had a case where someone was already detained. Usually the case is that their deportation order comes up, so they have like a week to go to their deportation order, and they say, will be final, and then they say, well, I got to do something in this last week, and sanctuary is an option to try to fight my case and stay with my family. So we haven't had any questions about bail and if the church is responsible for bail. There is a lot of insurance questions usually, and you should know that your general insurance, you know, will cover anybody who's on the property. But if you have questions about that, definitely check in with your insurance company. And there is on the sanctuary2014.org, there is a toolkit. There is a rapid response, safe haven type of one-page toolkit. And you can find more sanctuary toolkit there on the website. Feel free to give me a call. You all have my cell number from the invitation I sent out to the webinar. So I think that's all I have for now. But I'm sure there will be more questions and more thoughts as we continue.
Wonderful. Well, we want to thank strongly every speaker who has been with us, every participant who has plugged in. We remind you that indeed you will be receiving the visual portion and audio portion. We'll post it on the IIC website, interfaithimmigration.org, and we'll be sending it out as well over the next couple of days to everyone who had registered for this presentation. It is such a tragic time, a challenging time, as there seems to have been the political impetus in the current administration to try to use force, sadly, to show this way of attempting to deter individuals coming to this country, sadly, to deter individuals who are so deeply in need of safety. So we are grateful for our partnership as people of faith in your advocacy that you are engaged in. Please continue to keep calling the administration to let them know your distaste for these kinds of tactics. Plug in with Raul, consider as well, Sanctuary, send your questions to Allison, Noel, check the website of the Sanctuary movement that has been referred to, and we look forward to our ongoing work as faith partners together. And you can find on the final slide, as we show you each time through our Interfaith Immigration Coalition website, a number of contacts for each of the multiple denominations and faith partners who are together a part of the interfaith immigration. Our partnership with you is important. We ask for God's blessing on your ongoing work. And thank you again so much for taking time to join today. Especially thank you to each of our speakers, and Raul, to you, to Reverend Allison, to Jen, and to Noel from Church World Service. We deeply appreciate you, and we are in prayer for the important work you're doing every day. Thanks again for joining. Bye-bye.